tonight's speaker is the only speaker in the session that hasn't punished me in some way or another. So, yet. However, during the course of the meeting, he was inquiring about one of my collaborators, and I suspect the next time I introduce Werner, I may have a story to tell. Anyway, Werner has just done a fantastic job of taking these very complex molecules in mitochondria and putting them into their native context with tomography, and this whole system has just continued to evolve into a fantastically well-described and contextual system. So, Werner, I won't take any more of your time, and we'll find out the latest.
Thanks very much. See if I can get the microphone. Podium one. Is this one working?
Yes,
it's working. Great. Okay, so thanks, Jack. And I have the privilege of being the last speaker of the symposium. I'm very glad to see there's still some of you left. when Bridget asked me to speak, and I looked at the program and said, how can you do this to me, you know, put me last? And they said, well, you want a real highlight at the end, as they would. And I said, oh, yeah. And then Ron said, well, we'll actually lock the doors, you know, so nobody are the doors locked? Don't think so. I knew it would be empty promises anyway. So let me tell you what we I slightly changed the title to make it more general. So it's not just about ATP synthase and respiratory chain complexes, but also a lot of other things. And the mitochondria is a fascinating sort of cell organelle, and you can find out a great deal about it by our approach, which is has been of late electron tomography, certainly with respect to in situ structure of membrane proteins and other assemblies. So we're all on the same page. So you all know that mitochondria are the powerhouse of the eukaryotic cell, and nearly all the ATP that's consumed in eukaryotes is produced by them. They are semi-autonomous in the sense that they divide, fuse, and have their own, albeit fairly rudimentary genetic system. They import most of their protein, more than 1,000 proteins, and only a handful of, I think 13 are made within the mitochondrion itself. So it's a rather complex system. It has two membranes. The outer membrane is permeable, so it's not a diffusion barrier, whereas the inner membrane is a diffusion barrier and is not permeable to water and small molecules. As it turns out, mitochondria also have a very important role in aging and apoptosis. You probably know about the role in apoptosis, but we are studying aging, and this is actually also a fascinating aspect of mitochondrial structure. So by logical energy conversion, comes in two flavors, either the very basic here, photosynthesis, energy from sunlight, which is converted by these reaction centers into a proton gradient, which is then used by the ATP synthase to make ATP. And the same thing happens basically in mitochondria, except they don't do photosynthesis, they do respiration. And they metabolize energy from food, but the principle is the same. So these are proton pumps, and they pump protons across the membrane, and the gradient is then used by a very similar ATP synthase to make ATP. So this is the general principle, and it applies equally to chloroplasts and mitochondria. The main difference is the nature of the proton pumps here, reaction centers and photosynthesis, and respiratory chain complexes in mitochondria. And I won't say much more about chloroplasts, except a little bit later on we'll do a comparison, because even though the principle is the same, there are very interesting and important differences between the two systems. So this is a textbook view of mitochondria. where you see the outer membrane, the inner membrane, highly folded into cristae, surrounding the matrix, shown in dark blue here, and the inner membrane space, which is by and large, and because this is permeable to small molecules and ions and so forth, so the pH there would be about the same as in cytoplasm, which is less than 7.5, and in the matrix, the pH is quite a bit higher, close to 8. And this is the pH gradient of the ATP synthase uses to make ATP. So of course they don't really look like that, they look like this. So this is a movie of mitochondria in a human endothelial cell from umbilical cord. And it's time lapse, but it's not accelerated very much, I think by a factor of 10 or so. So you can see the mitochondria form a dynamic network, and they move around all the time along the microtubule network tracks, and they divide and fuse all the time. And you can, when you isolate them, there's some feedback here.
Turn it down.
How do they do that? Is that better?
Yes.
That's better. Anyway, so when you isolate mitochondria, you break the cells, and of course you also break the network. But the fragments that you get, they are still viable. They don't move around so much, but they respire, and they can actually also divide and fuse, as I will show you later. So this is a tomogram of such a fragment, which you can see the outer membrane and the inner membrane. This is cryo-electron tomography. You see the cristae reform an incredibly intricate kind of network within the outer membrane, and this is kind of a tomographic section of the same tomogram. This happens to be a mouse mitochondrion, but we spend a little bit of time looking at those, but it's much simpler looking at these kind of mitochondria, which are from, in this case, from Podospora, which I'll tell you more about later. They have much simpler structure. You can see the outer membrane very clearly. Again, this is a slice through a cryotomogram. You can see the cristae. You can see quite remarkably sharp turns at the ridges here, 90-degree turns, and you can see even sharper turns at the cristae junction. So this tells you there must be protein complexes involved there, because lipid membranes don't do that sort of thing on their own. They don't turn by this very sharp angle here. So there must be something going on there, of which, again, I will tell you more anon. So let's look at the ATP synthase, first of all, because this is the most conspicuous of the membrane protein complexes in the mitochondria. And this is a kind of a standard view of the respiratory chain, complex 1, 2, 3, 4, and ATP synthase, often also known as complex 5. And the X-ray structures of all these have been done, with the exception of one little bit here, which is subunit A, which actually is quite an important one, because it's responsible for the proton or ion translocation through this part of the complex and making this rotor go around. So this is how it's often depicted, or always depicted in textbooks, but that's not really how they sit in the membrane. So, and the first idea that this was not how it is came from an earlier paper by Richard Allen at the University of Hawaii, and he did deep edge electron microscopy of paramecium mitochondria, and he found these, you can probably not see them, but you can see there's sort of these rows of double rows of complexes, and he surmised, as it turns out correctly, that they were ATP synthase. And that was the first inkling that this is, you know, there's a non-random arrangement of these complexes in the inner mitochondrial membrane. But this for a long time, you know, for about 20 years, this was thought to be just a freak occurrence in paramecium or similar microorganisms, you know, ciliates, because they tried to look at bovine mitochondria, couldn't see anything by the same technique. So we then looked by cryotomography and saw these rather striking double rows. These are in isolated mitochondrial vesicles, so inner membrane vesicles, but the arrangement of the complexes remains intact We've since then done it also in whole mitochondria, but this is now a whole tableau of seven different species, you know, starting from rat liver, bovine heart, and three fungi, Eurovia, Podospora, which I've just shown you, and Saccharomyces, which you now do most of the work on, plants, and these protists, like Polytomela and Paramecium. They're both protists, and it turns out there are many more protists than any other forms of eukaryotic life on Earth, but so they all have exactly the same arrangement. I won't go as far as saying that all the ATP synthase is arranged like that, but certainly all the molecules we can see and call in confidence ATP synthase is arranged in dimeras, in these mitochondria, in all mitochondria, all healthy mitochondria. Right, so this is now a whole little one from Podospora. Again, quite transparent. You have these very tight junctions there, tight bends, and you have the cristae, and you have along these rows you have the dimers of the ATP synthase, and the purple balls here are ribosomes, and this tells you that the mitochondrion was intact. It has a matrix, and we can see the ribosomes floating around in the matrix. That means it hasn't leaked out, and the matrix is, which is quite dark, and you can see these, you know, darker blobs, which are the ribosomes and lots of other protein complexes, which you have no idea what they are. Right, so you can then take these and average them by subtomogram averaging, and this Karen Davis has done, and it's just been published a couple of months ago in PNAS, and so it's a very, very nice map, and because of this subtomogram averaging, you can also estimate the resolution. It's not fantastic, but it's certainly quite nice, and certainly nice enough to resolve the peripheral stalk here and the central stalk. This is the rotor that goes around, and this area where we fitted the atomic models, of course, being determined over the years in various laboratories, mainly Andrew Leslie and John Walker, who determined the structure of the bovine heart F1 complex, which fits nicely, and then there's various structures of the peripheral complex. They fit really very well, and even little details like this OCP subunit here, you can see a bump, and it fits there, even at 37 angstrom resolution. And we can't wait to get better data with these new direct detection cameras, and hopefully that will really improve the resolution and the level of detail. So we're very excited about that. Just a little bit of annotation. The rotor ring, we know what it looks like. There's Thomas Meyer in our institute who specializes in solving the structures of these. This is an AFM picture, and you can really count the number of subunits. So depending on the species, they have different numbers of subunits. In yeast, it's 10. In bovine, it's 8. And in various bacteria, it's more. In chloroplast, it's 14. So it really varies, and that determines, of course, how many protons you need to make an ATP. If you look at the map, the subtomogram average map, you can see if you slice through the F1 head, you can see these densities here, and it fits the F1 X-ray structure beautifully, and you can see the peripheral stalk here quite nicely. José Ferraldo Gómez and Claudio Anselmi at our institute have done some simulations. So they've taken the ATP synthase dimer as a rigid body and put it into a lipid bilayer and found that it bends the bilayer. Perhaps not very surprising. But then when you put another one next to it, bending of the bilayer has already happened, and therefore you spend less energy by putting a dimer next to it, and then another one, and that's how you end up getting these rows. And they can calculate the energy involved in that. So the elastic energy of elastic membrane deformation is about 6 kT, and that is less than you would have to expend if you had a protein-protein, or would gain, rather, from a protein-protein interaction. So this is, by definition, a more flexible arrangement. And if you have an organelle and you have a membrane that keeps fusing and dividing, it's quite important, probably, not to have protein-protein interactions which you have to break and then remake, but just rely on the lipid deformation to drive the formation of these dimer rows. A brief detour to chloroplasts. We've done the same thing on thylakoid members from chloroplasts and found that the arrangement there is entirely different. We don't have dimers. We have all the epicenter is monomeric, and it's confined to flat membrane surfaces at the end of the thylakoids or the stroma membranes. And if you look at chloroplasts, how much of a pH gradient they need to make ATP at a rate which can which enable cells to survive, and that's pretty much the maximum rate. You need to go to the maximum to really make enough ATP to keep cells alive. The pH gradient is you need for doing this is an in vitro experiment done already in 1991 by Peter Graeber and a colleague. So that fits very well with what we know about the chloroplasts. We have the stroma, which is the equivalent of the matrix of pH 8, and we have the lumen, which is pH much lower. Depending on the light intensity, can go up, can go down to about 5. So you have a pH gradient of up to 3, and that's fine. That's what you can do with to make lots of ATP. Now, how is the situation in mitochondria? In mitochondria, the same group has done the same experiment, in vitro reconstituted ATP synthase into liposomes and then created a pH gradient. This is a much more difficult experiment to do because the mitochondria ATP synthase is less stable, and that's why it's taken them a good long time to do this. And also, the maximum rate they get is not so high, probably because a few of the ATP synthases are not are dead, and actually the actual rates that you need are probably about a factor of 4 or 5 higher. But anyway, what these plots tell you that you need a matrix pH of around 8, which is we know what it is, it's been measured by fluorescent GFPs. But then you need a pH gradient of 2.9, and that would mean a Christie pH to really achieve maximal synthesis. You need a pH in the Christie of 5. Now, if you look at what I just told you, there is no pH gradient of 2.9 because we have the matrix 7.9, but out here it's 7.35. So that gives you a 0.6. And according to this experiment, that's nowhere near enough to make ATP at a sufficient rate. You can make a little bit down here, but that wouldn't be enough to enable the cell to carry out all its vital functions. So our contention is that this whole arrangement of the dimers at the tip and the proton pumps here at the side, as I will show you, is primarily to create a flow of protons, you know, from the pumps to the sink here at the ATP synthase. This is highly contentious, and just biologists just hate this idea. But I think there's no escape from it, because as the in vitro experiments have shown. And also, this is slightly misleading because A, they're much longer, these Christie, and B, they're often constricted at the end here by the Christie junctions. And in bovine heart, for instance, they're a tiny aperture of only about 20 nanometers in diameter. And in yeast, they're slit-like. So it's actually almost an enclosed volume. And this is kind of how we how I imagine it. So you have the dimer rows here at the ridges, at the Christie tips, but you need another complex to keep the whole thing together. And this is known as the Christie junction complex. I said it's hypothetical, but it has to be there. And there's a number of groups who have characterized this complex now genetically, and we are trying to go after it by cryotomography. So this is how the ATP synthase is organized in these long dimer rows. And what about the respiratory chain? Well, the respiratory chain in some organisms, including ourselves and mice and rats and so forth, bovine heart, it forms a supercomplex. It forms of the complex 1 and 3 and 4 together form a larger assembly. And this is actually, we've isolated this from blue native gels and looked at it by negative stain electron microscopy, and then another approach. We isolated it by on the gradient. If you look at at the tomogram of one of these vesicles that's pinched off the in the membrane, you can see the double rows, two of them here, making these two 90-degree angles, one red, one yellow. But you can see on the flat surface, you see complexes shown in green, and some of them are quite large, and those are the super complexes, many of them. And you can see them also in here next to the dimer rows in individual views, rendered views of these tomograms. And in one case, Karen Davies, who's doing this work, has been able to label one complex one with a quantum dot here. And this is one labeling approach we've taken. It's not, unfortunately, not very efficient. It's lousy efficiency of a few percent. So we're now trying metallocyanins, as I will show you, to as labels. But anyway, that sort of reassures us that these sort of boot-shaped densities we see are really the complex one matrix arm. And then often there's another bit density next to it, and that's complex three. And then, as I told you, we can isolate these from mitochondria, from Bovenhardt mitochondria, and then do cryo-EM, single particle cryo-EM on them, random conical tilt on thin carbon film. Here's some class averages, here's the reprojections. It's quite a nice map. This is a map of complex stabilized, or I should say solubilized, with amphipoles. Now, what are amphipoles? Amphipoles are polymeric amplifiers, like polymer detergents, if you will. And they render this complex water-soluble without the need for detergent. And that's quite an important asset, because detergents tend to take these large assemblies apart. So we've got the map. It's not particularly high resolution. It's between 20 and 30 angstroms. But it's good enough to fit all the component complexes. We have the complex 1 structure in blue, complex 3 in red, and complex 4 in green. And even down here, a little bump there is the cytochrome C, which is bound to complex 3. And there's actually an X-ray structure of the cytochrome C reductase, which is this in complex with one cytochrome C, and it fits really very nicely. And this is now slices through the complex, and this is was published last year, but this is from the supplementary materials, and what I want to draw your attention to. So this, if you slice through from the top to the bottom, it's really the soluble parts fit extremely nicely. This is here above the membrane plane, this is the matrix side, this would be the cristae side. Fits very, very nicely, even down to the little slice here through the cytochrome. But in the membrane, you get it looks hollow. And this sort of worried us a bit. The referees didn't seem to notice it or bother about it. But and it's probably a low-resolution contrast matching artifact, I think. But it looks empty. We know it's not empty. And above and below, it looks fine. So this must be simply because the density of the protein in the membrane with the lipid together, the average density is a lot lower, and therefore it appears to be at a much lower density. So this is the whole assembly, and it really has, with the exception of complex 2, the whole electron transfer chain in it. And so you get the electrons from the NADH up here, and then it goes through a chain of iron sulfur clusters and then makes a big jump, probably not along a straight line, it's transferred to ubiquitinol here, and then the ubiquitinol goes to the complex 3, where it is reduced, and the electrons are passed, electrons are passed along these cofactors to the cytochrome C, and then the cytochrome C actually moves physically to the cytochrome C oxidase, where it's oxidized and donates its electrons to, and then finally taken up by oxygen. And that's really respiration in a nutshell. And so why bother having such an assembly? And this is a criticism that has been leveled at us. Why do you need it? Because probably to make it more efficient is one aspect, but there's no real evidence that it makes it more efficient. But I think possibly the main reason for having this arrangement is as a protective measure against oxidative damage, because in this electron transfer chain, in the respiratory chain, you produce oxygen radicals at two points, one of them here and the other one there, as the electron is transferred to the ubiquinol or as it is taken up again away from the ubiquinol. And this, we don't know exactly how, but I believe there is evidence now coming out that this is indeed the case, that you have a supercomplex does protect against oxidative damage. And this is particularly important in long-lived animals, such as ourselves, or even in mice, when they only live for 3 years. And it's not important in yeasts and protosperant and short-lived organisms. And indeed, what we find, we only find this in higher eukaryotes, such as mammals, and you don't find it in yeast. Of course, yeast doesn't have a complex one at all, so you wouldn't expect the same. But so there's kind of a rationale why you have it in higher eukaryotes, but not in fungi. And so the question is, does it exist in the membrane? And actually, this was why we first got started with the whole electron tomography business, because we had this map, and people said, well, this is clearly an artifact. And so I said, well, we show it's not an artifact. We show it's there in the membrane. And then that's how we got started with tomography, because it's 1.7 megadaltons, and if it's there, we have to see it. And indeed, it is there. Indeed, we do see it. I've shown you a couple of views already. This is now a subtomogram average of the complex in the membrane from bovine heart. And as you see, it's not perfect. It's quite noisy, as they are, these subtomogram averages. There's not very many particles. But you can fit our green map, and you can also fit the atomic models. They don't fit perfectly, but certainly at least the matrix arm of complex 1 fits very well, and the matrix domains of complex 3 also. So we can be assured that it does exist in the membrane. Here's just three of these views. This is just the subtomogram average map. This is with our single particle map superimposed, and this is with the atomic models fitted. Right. Quick look at protein import. I've shown you that mitochondria import almost all their proteins, with the exception of maybe a dozen or so. And so we have a long-standing collaboration with the group in Freiburg of Klaus Pfanner, who studies this. And so we were curious to see if you could see the protein translocase in the outer mitochondrial membrane. And in order to do that, so first of all, we looked at chloroplast outer membranes in collaboration with a group in Frankfurt, Enrico Schleif. He isolates outer membranes. You look at them by tomography, and indeed we see densities. Not at very high resolution, but we can do some sort of subtomogram averaging, and you can see a dome structure. Not very detailed yet, but again, Bertram Daum, who's done this work with Enrico Schleif, has been able to use quantum dot labeling to make sure, A, this is the protein translocase, and B, where on which side particular subunits are. So two subunits have been labeled here with quantum dots. Again, not a very high labeling efficiency, but one or two a few are enough. You can probably get four or five to tell you that it's real and that these subunits are on a particular side of the complex. So how about the mitochondrial translocase? So this is a different, more complicated arrangement. The two complexes, the translocase of the outer membrane called TOM and the translocase of the inner membrane. The strategy is to design an import protein which gets stuck, which can't go through the translocation pore here. And there's a particular trick for doing that, which I won't have time to go into, and then to put an electron-dense tag at the end of that. And what you've chosen there is metallothionein. This is through the good efforts of David DeRosier and his student, Chris Mercoliano, and I think David told us about it in his talk. So we're trying to take this further and see if we can make use of it. It's a very, in principle, very elegant approach, and if we could have an expressible label for tomography, it would be a complete sea change. It would be like a GFP in light microscopy. But as yet, such a thing doesn't. This is the closest we have. But I'll show you there is room for improvement. So we did a control by making a construct of this transporter, a carnitine transporter, which is from E. coli, and we expressed it. This was 2D crystals originally, and then we solved the structure. This is one of the cases where we start with 2D crystals and then end up solving the X-ray structure because it turns out to be easier and you get to higher resolution. Anyway, we took this protein, and Thurston Bloom, who did the experiment, fused this metallocyanine tag to it and then reconstituted it in liposomes. And this is a tomogram of the reconstituted liposomes. And you see, interestingly, some of the liposomes are empty, but quite a few of them are not empty. We don't understand this. You observe this with a number of systems, that it seems to be some sort of cooperativity of the protein incorporation, that they all like to go into the same vesicles. And if you look at some of these at higher mag, you can see the metallocyanine tags on both sides of the membrane, as you would expect, because the protein is, you know, oriented upside down, or alternates in orientation relative to the membrane plane. So that's exactly what you would expect. Very gratifying. Works beautifully. Of course, you know where to look, and of course, there's quite a high density. So how about in the mitochondria? Well, this is a mitochondrion with a metallocyanine-labeled translocase in this nice way that I described. And if you look at the surface, there are indeed little black dots. And you can, and Vicky, who's done the experiment together with people in Freiburg, she's averaged them, and this would be a metallocyanine solution, again averaged, so it's rather similar in size, and they all have the same distance from the membrane and so forth. But it's, you know, it could do with being a little bit stronger, actually. And if you look at the control, you also have little black dots, but not so many, and they're more irregular, but still. This is only the beginning, and we're now looking for ways of enhancing this label or using bigger labels and so forth. But anyway, it's quite a neat approach. And of course, the background is quite low in these isolated mitochondria. But if you were looking for something in the matrix, you'd have a tough time, right, with this approach. Anyway, very briefly, crystal junctions. They have to be there, because otherwise you couldn't have this sharp bend here at the where the crystal branch out from the boundary membrane. But what do they look like? And so if you look closely, I've shown you this before, if you look closely at these crystal junctions, you can see some sort of density in there. It's more clear in the porospora, because the mitochondria are smaller and you have less noise, less background. So you can see kind of a Y-shaped density there. There's one there, there's another one there. So this is the beginning. We have the three groups have characterized these as a complex of six different proteins. And we'll now try and, you know, tease them apart, label them with metallocyanins to see, get an idea where they are and how they hang together. Again, this is be great to have better images, and I think these new cameras that we now have will make a huge difference to getting more detail, more contrast. Very quickly, mitochondrial fusion. I've told you they mitochondria are sort of semi-autonomous. They fuse and divide. And recently, this, if you look here, there's this little guy here which sort of zips around, and then it gets fused to this string here, and then, you know, loses its individuality and becomes part of the network. And it's just one instance of fusion, and there's quite a few of them in this field. Because there are two membranes, there are two fusion machineries. There's one for the outer, this is fission, which is also interesting. But the fusion that we are now hoping to look at is more complex, because you have to fuse. This is just sort of pinching off, basically. It's a kind of a dynamin-like thing where you have you form a constriction, and then this pinches off the two, you know, sort of part mitochondria. But the fusion is much more complex, because you need to have two machineries, one for the outer membrane, one for the inner membrane, and they need to be somehow coordinated. So people are just beginning to look at that by light microscopy and so forth. But we struck up a collaboration with Michael Cohen in Paris, and he's got an in vitro fusion assay, so he can make mitochondria and then add this factor FCJ1, and you can induce them to fuse. And in the field of view, you can either get separate mitochondria or they're tethered, sort of stick together, and then they become fused in this way. So they have two mitochondria within one outer membrane. That's where it stands at the moment, which is very recent work. And of course, we're keen to do this by cryotomography to see if you can glean any structure here at these contact sites, or then later at these fusion sites. Last topic, aging, which will, catch up with all of us, some sooner, some later. Not looking at anyone in particular, but so mitochondria are implicated in aging, and this has been known, but it's not known how, really. And so we struck up a collaboration with a group in Frankfurt who's studying this Podospora fungus, which I've mentioned a couple of times because it has nice, small, transparent mitochondria. And this is an amazing beast. It is a filamentous fungus. It's a close relative of Neurospora. And it has a fixed lifespan of 20 days or less. And so by growing mycelia in petri dishes, you can actually mark off the days and then cut out bits and say, here I have a 6-day-old culture, here I have a 9-day-old culture, and here I have a 15-day-old culture. And then you isolate mitochondria from them and look at them. And this is what you see. So this is the one you've seen before from a young culture, and this is from an old culture. And they really are completely different. Not at the first glance, but here you have clear, nicely developed cristae, sharp edges, cristae junctions. This looks at first sight like cristae, but it's not. It's actually, these are the the matrix has vesiculated into separate vesicles. So that's a dramatic change. And if you have, the membrane curving one way here, you have it curving the opposite way here. So the question is, what happens to the ATP synthase dimerase, which you know sit at these tight edges here? And what happens is very interesting. So this is, again, the tomographic volume of the young mitochondria you've seen before. This is one of a middle-aged one. An old one. They occur similar stages in the same culture often, but this is one that has sort of partly vesiculated, so it still has one large vesicle where you still have double rows, but instead of cristae, deeply invaginated cristae, you have these shallow ridges, which look remarkably like the computer simulation of the dimerase, so the dimers just bend the membrane, but there's nothing obviously at the other end to pull the ends in. So the cristae junction complex must have disassembled at that stage. And if you then go one step further and to these vesicles, so this would be these smaller vesicles here, which don't have any dimers that we can tell. And if you do so distance analysis and histograms, you see here in this vesicle, which you've again seen before, we have two nice dimer rows. You measure the distance between all F1 heads and you do a histogram and you find these three distances, which are multiples of the distance along the row, and then this distance D2 here is the distance across the row. And in these vesicles that have inverted curvature, there's nothing, there's no such peaks, there's just one maximum, which is the average center-to-center distance between the F1 heads. So the dimers have actually dissociated. What happens to the ATP synthase itself? So this is the standard view. It's in young, healthy, normal mitochondria. As you've seen, you have the central stalk, the peripheral stalk, the dimer, you have the membrane with this sharp bent there. We have fitted the atomic models. Now, in these aging or older cultures, you still have the dimers, but you have a much shallower membrane. And it's convex here, but it becomes concave further out. And if you look at the subsequent average, there's an extra bit of density there, which we don't know what it is, but it might be a protease acting on the subunits that are holding the dimer together. We have no idea, but this is something we want to find out. And then finally, in the very old vesicles, you only have monomers, and again, you can fit the atomic model. You don't see the you don't resolve the peripheral stalk because these are randomly oriented, and the signal just isn't good enough to orient them with respect to the peripheral stalk. So this is what happens in this model organism. From juvenile to senescent, you have an inversion of the curvature at the ape synthase, and you have a dissociation of the dimer into monomers. Now, what would that do? First of all, we have this bit of empty space where we have what we know to be subunit-specific, dimer-specific subunits, e.g., and the first transmembrane helix of the peripheral stalk, and they must occupy this part of the map where we have not resolved anything, but maybe with better cameras, better definition, we can resolve something. We're also trying to crystallize them separately and find out what they look like. But anyway, what we have done is to look at mutants that are knockouts in this, or this. And in what you do, what you get then, you lose the dimers. They don't have dimers anymore. And this was borne out by tomography. Here's a little vesicle from this from wild type, and it has the dimers nicely around the perimeter of this flattened vesicle. And in the subunit G knockout, we don't have these flattened vesicles, and we have the ATP synthase monomers on the flatter surfaces, very much as in chloroplasts. And the consequence of that would be, is known from these mutants. They've been studied not by us, but by people who first designed them 10 years ago, that mitochondria cannot assemble dimers. They have member potential that's reduced by quite dramatically. They cannot respire as efficiently, and they have a similarly extended generation time. So if you don't have a dimer, you're at a severe disadvantage compared to other organisms that do have it. And that, to me, that means that they cannot produce enough ATP to keep the cell fit and healthy, and aging cells with an increasing proportion of dysfunctional mitochondria are less fit and will eventually die. And in an organism like Podospora, which just has, you know, sort of cells which are more or less in synchrony, and once they all reach that stage, then the whole organism dies. How does it die? Well, we've done some again here some movies of tomograms, and we've seen some amazing things which you don't fully understand. But we in these very old so they're not very old, they're about 15 to 20 days, we see a formation of contact sites here with three green arrows. And this is something we don't see at any other stage of the of these mitochondria. We don't know what it means, but what we also see is that the inner membrane vesicles that have, you know, separated, they attach to the outer membrane here and there, for instance, and it seems to be bulging out. And what this appears to may be due to, we don't know for sure, but maybe due to that, at this site where they come very, very close together, we can't resolve the space between the inner and outer membrane anymore, which is very unusual, because otherwise they're quite nicely separated. At this site, what may happen, that the inner membrane becomes leaky and swells, and then once these vesicles have swollen, the outer membrane becomes too tight and ruptures. And this is actually what we do see in some sites. And when that happens, then, of course, the cytochrome C, which would now be in this space, is released, and you end up with the cell dying by apoptosis. So that's a little diagram showing what I've just told you about the different stages. So this is standard morphology, nicely developed crystal junction complex here in blue, the dimer rows at the end, and the proton pumps in green along the sides. Then this first thing that happens probably is this comes apart, the junctions widen, the intermembrane space widens, and you have these dimer rows and these shallow ridges, And finally, you get the dispersion along these vesicles, so it's random arrangement of monomers in these vesicles. And very finally, you get vesicle swelling, vesicle attachment. Don't yet know what that means or what it is due to, and then local rupture and release of cytochrome C into the cytoplasm. So that's for Podospora. We are curious to see how this relates to other organisms, and this is, will occupy us for quite a few years, I should think. Anyway, this brings me to the end. Single particle team of Jeanette and Derek, who are the core of our EM facility, and Thorsten Alto has done the nice 3D map of the super complex. Doran Matthies, I haven't really talked about. Haven't talked about her work, but she's just finishing and she is looking for a postdoc, and you can all apply to her to be a postdoc, because she's really excellent. She has solved an X-ray structure of one of these C rings, of an unusual one, interesting one. She's done. She's expressed HP synthase in cell-free system, the whole thing, and shown that it's functional. So all 22 components. And she's a brilliant biochemist as well. Anyway, if you have a need for a really great postdoc, let her know. And the tomography team, most of the work I've shown has been done by Bertram Daum. He's also finishing his PhD. He's another really excellent student, Karen Davis, who is a postdoc joining us from Oxford. Thorsten Blum has done the metallocyanine experiments. He'll also finish soon. Anyway, all the work that I've shown you has been done on our Polara, I think, with I think almost no exception, and which is our real workhorse. And it's a great microscope. We now also have use of a Titan Cryos, which is used for tomography, but that's been quite recent. And what we find is that the Polara is really mechanically a better microscope. So the tracking for the tomograms is a lot more reliable. And so if you have a Polara, look after it well, because they don't make them anymore, and you may never get a better microscope. Anyway, but one thing that's of imminent is the retirement of our JL3000. This is Derek here and Jeanette, and Derek has looked after it for ever since we moved. I moved to the Max Planck in Frankfurt in 96, so it's now coming up to 16th year, done faithful service, and we have a goodbye party in next week. So if you're in the area, come round. Yeah, and there's Derek, you know, sort of a self. He's a bit of a spare time artist, and he's drawn this picture, and he sort of in his hand he holds a book, you know, how to fix it if it gets broken, first and last edition. And she says, now, Jeanette, what have we forgotten to do? And Jeanette is in a cold sweat here, and so all these, and it's quite a beast, this microscope, to operate. And it's, you need to really know what you're doing. And so we won't be entirely sorry to see it go, because it's also, you can only do one thing very well, which is electron crystallography, but we need one that can do tomography. And we're replacing it by a GL3200 now, next month, which will have a K2 camera at the bottom here, and so that will be a very powerful machine with an in-column filter and a direct detector at the other end. So that's something we are very greatly looking forward to. And you know, we're quite well equipped. We have Polara, we have part of a Titan Cryos with a K2 at the end of a. So that was my iPhone. telling me 45 minutes is up. Anyway, we have the JL3200. So if you're looking for a good place to do a postdoc, you know, it's let me know. This is Frankfurt. If you come from this country, you feel right at home, because it's you've got the highest number of high rises, and these are all banks, including the European Central Bank. But there are also some nice old historic buildings, like this the Cathedral, which used to be the coronation church for the German emperor and emperors until about 200 years ago. So anyway, it's a great place. We have a great institute, a great lab. So if you're interested in a postdoc, let us know. Okay. Yes, we have got hold of deletion all deletion strains. We haven't looked at them yet. That's exactly what we're doing. Yeah. And not only that, but we want to replace the deleted strains by metallothionein constructs. Right. They also that's also in hand. Yeah, and then we'll take it from there.
Does overexpression of the G subunit result in prolonged youth? If I understood your model correctly.
Overexpression of the G subunit. That's right, sure. Yeah, I'm not sure the converse is true because there's some sort of mechanism that breaks it down. And it maybe this little extra density that we found.
That protease you were talking about.
It could, well, we don't have no idea what the protease. It could be. It's a potentially protease. We know that the crystal junction complex probably is taken apart by proteolytic cleavage. And proteases play many different roles in these processes. So that's it's a wild speculation, but it's and so it wouldn't help you to have more because each
unless
dimer
you keep that protease busy
chewing up something else, yeah. Right? If that's a the, you know,
competitive model.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Anyway, it's a nice idea. But first of all, we have to see whether it's actually similar things happen in mice, for instance, or you know, C. elegans. That's what we're going to do.
Cool. Yeah, I guess the reason why this theory with the pH gradient, is controversial is that the normally such a gradient would very quickly equilibrate through protein jumping. So what is your idea that this is somehow not happening so efficiently there?
Well, I've done some back-of-the-envelope calculations, which are not difficult. So, and the upshot is that in this volume of a crystal, let me see if I can. This is kind of back-of-the-envelope calculations for crystal volume. You know, each ATP synthesis makes 580 per second, needs 3 protons. Each dimer has uses so and so many protons per second. At pH 7, there are so many protons per cubic nanometer. Crystal volume, and this would convert to 7 times 10 to minus 4 protons in that volume. Yeah, not enough. Even at pH 6, you know, have 10 to minus 3. So you need a constant stream protons, and they do move. Let me see if I can. They do move. There's not another talk. Don't worry about it. You've seen that. Yeah. So they move quite rapidly along membrane surfaces, and if you have
is this actual movement of the protons, or just
how quickly the pH changes. This has been done with perfect membrane, for instance. Yeah. So, and along a proton wire, this is Gerhard Hummer has done those calculations inside a carbon nanotube. They move even faster. It's almost roughly a factor of, five or ten. Yeah. So you know, it's hard to prove, but it's my contention is they just move along the membrane surface and they flow towards the sink, you know, where the ATP synthase is, and uses them up, and the proton pumps keep replenishing them. So it's kind of flow equilibrium. But we're trying to measure the pH in the crystal, not by, again, by the same ratiomeric GFPs. That's in progress as well.
Richard?
Could the empty spaces that the referees didn't notice between your complex 1, 2, and 4 be filled with amphipoles?
No. The amphipoles are, could, but you know, we know they're not because that's where the alpha helices are, the transmembrane helices. Yeah, so we know it's not amphipoles. The amphipoles wrap around the edge, and we actually see density around the edge. Yeah, but in the inside, there's lipid and membrane-spanning helices, and they just don't show up very well at 20 to 30 angstrom resolution. But I've seen similar maps with exactly the same effect, but people don't normally like to talk about it.
Back there.
I had a related question. In the subtomogram averages for that respiratory super complex, it looks like the volume is still there between the.
That's just because it's. That's just a membrane, and we just don't resolve anything in the membrane, basically. You mean this, where is it? This one here. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is just lipid bilayer, and it's not differentiated. We can't tell in these tomograms, because it's really quite low, that's really quite even low resolution. We can't tell the difference between protein and lipid at this, because the membrane is just a dark line in the tomogram. It's to do with defocus and also, you know, doctoring of the volume, what's it called, denoising, right? So it just means you cannot really resolve anything within the bilayer.
Sure.
Just had a comment on the hollowness of the complex. Could that be a low resolution artifact of your CTF correction?
Yeah.
You somehow haven't.
Could well be. Could well be. Yeah. Yeah. Quite possibly. Even though, you know, up here it seems to work quite nicely, and that's just as low frequencies. But it's entirely possible. Yeah.
The envelope looks nice.
Very nice envelope.
But I agree with Schwarz.
Yeah.
You know, the bigger the
the
volume is, the more likely, because the, you know, the CTF tends to emphasize the edges, and so the bigger thing,
right,
you have space for the whole.
Yeah. Well, perhaps worth. It's nothing fancy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I guess we're going to have a wrap up now. Are you chairing that, or who's wrapping up?
I think you just did.
I should perhaps. I'm not the official wrapper-upper, but I should say it's been a fantastic meeting, and I would like to thank Bridget and Clint and Ron. And I've enjoyed every minute of it. And I've been in this business for 30 years, and I've learned something new every day. And so it's been wonderful, and I'm very glad that I came and I stayed for the whole time.
And I would just like to emphasize the aspect that. As a colleague here, I mean, Bridget and Clint are absolutely at the top of the line in terms of people to interact with. They really have a marvelous can-do sort of attitude, it's so much fun to have so many people coming here to be able to use this facility and so forth, and then to have these meetings where we gather everybody at one time. So. I would have a hearty round of applause for Bridget and Clint and all of their colleagues here that have put so much time and effort. This, as everybody knows, this organized meetings, they don't just happen. They it takes a lot. So.
And Ron and Lorraine.
Right.
Ron and Lorraine, yes.
So